History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. James, here we are, the moment when America enters the war. I know for us as Americans, we might hype this up, and if we have European listeners, they might think we're making more of this than it probably deserves in the scope of the war. But
USA, you know, USA, exactly. USA.
This is when World War I really matters, people, because America's there.
The rest was just prelude, right? No, we're kidding. We're kidding, people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're kidding, and we're going to talk about that very thing because there's a lot of question even today about what America's role was in the war and should America have even been involved. And Americans themselves will ask that question sometime. And because I think you've taught this to students many times in the past, and you've probably gauged their knowledge of what World War I is. And I'd like to start us off with that. So, James, when you introduce World War I to students and you ask what they know about it, what does a 21st century student say? What do they even think of when they hear World War I?
Well, I teach at the community college level, and so the average student I have knows almost nothing about anything. I mean, it's history-wise, anyway. I don't mean to say they don't know anything. They know things, but history they're usually pretty weak on. So you can imagine going World War I, they know almost nothing about it. They might have heard of, you know, they may have faint remembrances of the Lusitania or the Zimmerman telegram, things like that. But sometimes they'll mix up the Titanic with World War I, but they really don't know a lot about it. When World War I is taught in American schools, at least if in the context of an American history class. And I do this too, by the way, because the course I teach is American history. It is taught mainly from the viewpoint of the United States. So teachers, high school teachers and community college professors like myself, we don't really go into much detail about the things you and I have talked about so far. We don't really talk much about the Marne and the Somme, Verdun, Jutland, things like that, Gallipoli. We just kind of say, well, okay, a war broke out in Europe and they fought for 3 years and then the U.S. joined. So if they know anything, students do, for the most part, it is very Amero-centric, if you will, you know, very focused on the U.S. And, you know, that's part of why we're doing this series, because we want to give people a more broad knowledge. And I mean, because the Americans were really Johnny-come-latelys, weren't they, Scott? I mean, they jumped in 3 years plus after the war had started. And again, were they the tipping point? Were they the force that won the war for the Allies and crushed the Germans, or not? That's what we're going to look at today.
It's really how you want to fight a war. You don't suffer the horrible ravages and destruction of your cities, but you do get to come into the end. You get to have a place at the diplomatic table and the negotiation and everything. But to get back to your point on how World War I can wash over people, one anecdote I have from my family is a few years ago, I was reading my grandfather's memoirs. Well, memoir sounds like it's a 400-page tome. It's more like 60 or 70 pages he wrote out at the end of his life and then printed it out, and my family and I passed it around. He was born in 1910, and he lived to 2003. He was in the Navy in the 1930s. He got out before World War II started. He was in his 30s by World War II, so a little bit too old to be in active combat. He served on a ship, Arizona, that, you know, has a certain place in history. And he was part of a whole litter of farm kids. So he had a much older brother who's about 15 years older than him, who actually served in World War I. And then he had a younger brother who was in the Pacific Theater in World War II. But anyway, in his memoirs, he's writing about World War I, just kind of talking about the early 20th century. And he just had a funny little anecdote, and I didn't get a chance to look this up to see how this was passed around, but some story about how Theodore Roosevelt is meeting with Kaiser Wilhelm and saying, "Bill, you put together an army that could whip the whole world." And by golly, Bill tried to do that a few years later. So he was alive in World War I, and that's about as much impact on it as it had on him, and even served in the military. So if World War One didn't make much impact on someone who's alive at that time and would have grown up and had family members who served, then here we are generations later. There was a poll taken at the centennial of the outbreak of World War One by YouGov and asked Americans about their knowledge of it or what was their opinion of World War One and whether America should have been involved. And less than half of Americans said the U.S. had a responsibility to fight in World War One. 21% said the U.S. didn't have a responsibility, and 33% didn't know. And for those who don't know, I've read and there are those who argue that America shouldn't have been involved anyway because we entered the conflict too late to claim much credit. Some say we didn't have any compelling national interest to enter the war. At the very worst, they would say that the intervention allowed Britain and France to absolutely crush Germany to the level that they established peace treaty terms that made the rise of Adolf Hitler inevitable. They argue that if we'd stayed out of the war, Europe would have made a more reasonable peace. There wouldn't have been the same post-war animosity, and maybe World War II could have been prevented. And we'll look at that idea a little bit more in our conclusion to the series. But part of the disillusionment for those who don't like World War One in the United States is that they blame it on Woodrow Wilson, that he's preaching peace to keep us out of the war, but then he changes tune rapidly. And I'll let you take over, James, on Woodrow Wilson in a second. But I don't think I'm editorializing too much when I say I'm not a fan of his administration. And he's one of the few presidents, I would say, whose administration really improved after he had a stroke. So not many other people I can say.
Yeah, Wilson's star has really fallen a lot in the last, 20, 30 years or so. But we're not going to go into a great amount of detail about him. He's a fascinating character. No one can deny that. And really very much an enigma. A lot of our presidents are very hard to understand at a deep level. But and Wilson is one of these, but let's look at a little bit of his background. I think it's helpful to understand his background, and his background kind of sheds a lot of light on why we went into the war and the policies that we implemented during and after the war. So Wilson grew up in Virginia and other parts of the South. His father was a minister and they moved around a lot, but generally sticking to the South. I think they spent some time in South Carolina, Georgia, if I remember correctly. He attended Princeton University and then he later taught there. And eventually he became the president of the university. I always tell my students that Wilson is the only U.S. president to have ever earned a PhD, at least an earned doctorate. And he was a history professor, so yay. Yeah. He wrote a lot of books, and he was a Southern apologist, too. Interestingly enough.
Lost cause myth proponent.
Yeah, he really was. And it's kind of, I'll give you a little anecdote of my own. When I went to UT Austin back in the 80s, they had all these Confederate statues. They had Jefferson Davis, Robert E. Lee, they had Albert Sidney Johnston, the general who was from Texas, and they had some other kind of Confederate or later kind of Jim Crow leaders. And then there was one of Woodrow Wilson. And a lot of people asked, why Woodrow Wilson? He doesn't really fit. And it's because he was a Southern apologist. Anyway, so he, as I said, he became the president of Princeton. Then he was eventually went into politics very late in life. He was elected governor of New Jersey in 1910 and then U.S. president in 1912. And I have to say, the only reason he was elected president, he was a Democrat. The only reason he was elected president is because the Republicans split. Most of our listeners are probably aware of the famous split between Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. I think if the Republicans had stuck together, they would almost certainly have won. But you had a lot of big egos at that time, and so that was not going to happen in 1912. Wilson was a devout Presbyterian, one of the most religious presidents we've ever had, most devout Christian presidents we've ever had. He believed that he was being used by God to bring changes worldwide. He saw himself as an outsider and above politics. He tried to communicate directly with the American people, bypassing political institutions. A lot of our most famous presidents have done that. And when the war broke out in 1914, he was determined to keep the U.S. neutral. He really didn't want to get involved. But as we're going to see, events are going to carry him along, and it's going to become just about inevitable. He ran for re-election in 1916, and he won. His slogan was, "He has kept us out of war," or sometimes, "He kept us out of war." which is kind of ironic. I'm the guy that kept us out of war. 1 year later, joins the war. That would be a good internet meme, I think. But he also wanted to mediate an end to the war. He had a very high view of himself and his skills and abilities, and he saw himself as God's chosen instrument to bring this war to an end. The Europeans rejected his offer. You know, they didn't really care much for Wilson. They saw him as this, you know, starry-eyed dreamer, you know, almost like a flower child of the 1910s. They saw him as sanctimonious and self-righteous, which is true to a certain extent. And, you know, who's this guy to come over here and tell us what we can do and what we can't do? So that's a little background of Wilson.
Yeah, there's the unctuousness, if there's a word I describe it, where I am a one-term president, but I am going to bypass all that and immediately leap up to elder statesman. In my days in history academia, I can think of many people who have Wilsonian attributes that I think, you know, if I could just, I'm already such an intelligent person. I need to control the world. People should be asking me what to do. But his policy of he kept us out of the war, there are shades of, I suppose, George H.W. Bush's read my lips, no new taxes in the 1992 presidential campaign. So interesting take there. But he's reelected and then we get up to the war.
I think his heart was in the right place. I think he really did want to do good. But just the way he came across definitely rubbed the European leaders the wrong way. Okay, so events are going to take him in another direction. So when war broke out in 1914, really not very many Americans were interested in getting involved. Americans saw that as their problem. It's a European war. You know, remember George Washington said, don't get involved in European affairs and let's just stay out. It's not our business. In addition to that, there had been about 12 million immigrants who had come to America just since 1900, and of course, many more before that. And many of these immigrants who had come from Europe since 1900 as younger men or women, or not women, the women weren't conscripted, but a lot of the men had been conscripted into various European armies. And they'd been in the army, the European-style military service, and even wars, and they wanted no part of war. A lot of our immigrants were from Germany or Austria-Hungary, and they still had family over there. In addition, you had Irish immigrants who certainly had no love for the Allies, especially not the UK. The UK had been mistreating the Irish for a long time, and these Irish Americans had absolutely no interest in fighting on the same side as Britain. But in spite of that, most Americans nevertheless sympathized with the Allies. Plus, American trade had increased with the Allies due to British naval policy, especially the blockade, while trade with Germany had been virtually eliminated. It's kind of ironic to me, Scott, that the British basically told Americans, you can't trade with Germany or any of the Central Powers, and you have to trade with us. You know, we'll buy your stuff. It's not like they're stealing the stuff like they used to do back in the 1700s and early 1800s. They're paying for it now.
Okay, that's better.
But they really were pretty much told American shippers what they can do and what they can't do. And not that many Americans were all that mad about it. They said, oh, okay, fine. Now, at the same time as that, you had German sinkings of ships. We've talked a little bit about the U-boats in previous episodes. These ships contained Americans, and a lot of Americans went down with the ships. And these sinking of these merchant vessels caused the Americans to turn against the Germans. The most famous sinking, of course, is the Lusitania, which was in 1915. That was a luxury liner, kind of like the Titanic, but not the same as the Titanic. And when the Lusitania was sunk, there were 1,200 people drowned or otherwise killed in the explosions, and among those were 128 Americans. But that was not by any means the only ship that was sunk on which Americans lost their lives. There was another one called the Sussex in 1916, and these sinkings caused a great deal of outrage among Americans. And of course, the British really played this up. The British were propaganda masters, as we've mentioned before, and a lot of Americans, too, really wanted to go to war, and they really played these sinkings up and said, these are Americans. they should never be fired upon. Wilson demanded to the Germans that American lives should be respected. And the Germans said, hey, these guys were on ships. We warned you. And plus, the Lusitania was carrying armaments, which is true. It really was. So, you know, it wasn't as black and white as you might think. But still, it's a terrible thing. And Americans were becoming more and more anti-German as a result of these sinkings. In fact, the sinkings led to a movement among the American people called the Preparedness Campaign. The preparedness advocates wanted an expanded and well-trained U.S. Army and Navy in the event that America were to join the war. And they actually did. I've read that some interesting stuff. They got a bunch of young guys and they set up these quasi-military camps where they trained them and they drilled them as if they were real. They weren't in the Army, but they were just getting them ready. Oh, I guess almost like an ROTC situation, but it wasn't quite that official. One of the key leaders of the preparedness movement was Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt was dying to go to war. You know, he was one of our most bellicose presidents. He wanted to be a major general. He wanted to lead a division. That's not going to pan out. But anyway, so America is gradually moving in the direction of war. Some Americans didn't want to wait. They volunteered to join European forces. Some Americans joined the French Foreign Legion. Others became pilots and joined the French Air Service. And they had their own unit, which eventually became known as the Escadrille Lafayette. And it had a lot of exploits and a lot of interesting stories. There's a really good book where they talk about this called To the Last Man by Jeff Shara, or Shara. He pronounces it Shara. We'll put that in our list of books. I highly recommend it. It is a novel, but it's very, very good.
And also one other thing too with film, James Franco has a book called, or a movie called Flyboys about them, which I do not recommend. So that is on my do not watch list.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad World War One movies. I've tried not to watch them myself. Just like there's bad World War II movies and bad other war movies. Yeah. Stick to our list, people. You don't want to waste 2 hours of your life. All right. So as this war fever is building up, President Wilson tried to calm the increasingly pro-war passions of Americans. He tried to chart a middle ground. He gave a famous speech in which he argued that Americans were too proud to fight. That phrase really stuck out. Too proud to fight. Theodore Roosevelt was not happy about that. He's like, what?
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
But anyway, between 1914 and 1917, American production greatly increased. So the U.S. is going to make a lot of money off of the war for sure. Steel production increased 76%. American exports quadrupled. American loans helped finance the Allied war effort. And America went from being a debtor nation to a creditor nation. So we're turning from not the most economically powerful country in the world to the most powerful by far. In February of 1917, we touched on this in a previous episode, but it bears repeating. Germany announced the resumption of unrestricted submarine warfare. And that was pretty much the last straw, or one of the second to the last straw for the U.S. The U.S. broke diplomatic relations with Germany and began arming merchant vessels. Previously, they had not been armed, of course. Germany took several U.S. citizens prisoner. They had been on captured American vessels. And then the last straw finally occurs. The foreign minister of Germany, Arthur Zimmermann, sent a telegram to Mexico, and the British intercepted this telegram. They turned it over to Wilson, and then on March 1st, Wilson made it public. The Zimmermann telegram, as it's called, had been sent to Mexico, and in it, Zimmermann proposed that Mexico go to war with the U.S. with German support. In return, Germany would make sure that Mexico received the states of Texas. Wait a minute. Hold on. What? Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico as compensation. So this is a crazy scheme. I mean, there's no way Mexico was going to declare war against the U.S. They were still in the middle of their own civil war, but nevertheless, this was the last straw. This infuriated Americans when they found out about it. And so finally, on April 6, 1917, the U.S. formally declared war on Germany. And in his war message, Wilson famously said that the world must be made safe for democracy. But he also wanted the U.S. to be somewhat aloof and above the whole fray, even as they're getting into the fray. He said the U.S. was not joining the Allies. We're not going to become an allied nation. We're going to be an associated power. So whatever that means. But anyway, after Wilson's war speech, he went back to his office and he wept. So again, Wilson really wasn't happy with going to war, but he just felt like he had no choice at this point. What do you think, Scott?
Well, we talked about what ifs and how Wilson was a very different president from a Teddy Roosevelt. There's actually an alternate history series called the Black Chamber series by S.M. Sterling. And I'm a sucker. I like alternate history. I love these thought experiments and how they play out. And I think it can help us to look at history and we consider test cases and A-B split cases, if you want to get into internet marketing parlance. But there's a quote from Teddy Roosevelt about this and everything happening. And he argues that if America had been preparing for war and arming itself, speaking softly and carrying a big stick, then Germany wouldn't be engaging in unrestricted submarine warfare, which for America, they thought this was war crimes because the submarine isn't surfacing before it fires. It doesn't give the crew a chance to evacuate and innocents are being killed. He wrote in March 1917 that Germany's policy of unrestricted submarine warfare was a manifest act of war against the United States and should be treated as such. Here's what he wrote. Germany has sunk our ships. Our ports have been put under blockade. If these are not overt acts of war, then Lexington and Bunker Hill were not overt acts of war. It is well to remember that during the last 2 years, the Germans have killed as many, or almost as many Americans, as were slain at Lexington and Bunker Hill. And whereas the British in open conflict slew armed American fighting men, the Americans whom the Germans have slain were women and children and unarmed men going peacefully about their lawful business. So Wilson, in contrast, instead of recognizing what this would be as acts of war like Roosevelt did, he was behind the British Royal Navy, and he said that the slowing pace of U-boat attacks was due solely to the efficiency of the British Navy. We have done nothing to secure our own safety or vindicate our honor. We've been content to shelter ourselves behind the fleet of a foreign power. So had Roosevelt been president, let's say the Bull Moose Party ticket had been successful in his third party campaign, we probably would have entered much sooner and had a much different role in World War One and been more involved for better or for worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And many more people would have been killed, too. But who knows how it would have impacted the war? Perhaps it would have ended earlier. Yeah. You know, it's one of those famous what ifs that we'll never really know.
So, American propaganda, war aims over there. The band starts playing. So yes. What happens next?
It's interesting. I always point out to my students that in 1915, the number one song in America was a song called "I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier." I tell my students, if you think that anti-war songs are only from the 1960s, you're wrong. They started much earlier. In fact, there've been anti-war songs with every war we've ever been in. But yeah, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I don't want him to go over there and kill some other mother's son. It's very sentimental. We'll put a link to the song. You can find it on YouTube. 2 years later, in 1917, the number one song in America was "Over There," which almost everybody at least knows a little bit of that song. And I think that's going to be a big part of our podcast.
It's a fun song. It's got a great beat.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes you practically want to march it right out there and sign up yourself. But I'm too old, unfortunately, or fortunately, perhaps. But anyway, so what caused this major turnabout? Well, the U.S. government got heavily involved in propaganda and whipping up war fever. So we'll take a look at what they did here. First of all, they portrayed the Germans, and in particular Kaiser Wilhelm, as evil monsters. You know, it's funny. Dan Carlin talks about this in his podcast series on World War One. We, in the 21st century, we look back and we see World War II, and we think of the evil Adolf Hitler. And then when you look back at World War One, when you compare Kaiser Wilhelm with Adolf Hitler, I mean, Wilhelm just looks like a bumbling, you know, kind of a goofball, incompetent, hapless person. He doesn't seem to us as some evil monster because we've got Hitler as the standard as an evil, evil dictator. But back then, of course, nobody had ever heard of Adolf Hitler. So they did see Kaiser Wilhelm as this evil monster. And if you look at propaganda posters from the time, he's always he or just a generic German soldier is always shown in a kind of a diabolical fashion. They look like this dark, evil monster with a, often with a knife in his hand, with blood coming off of the knife. So that's one thing the government did, was demonize the enemy, and particularly the Germans. Wilson portrayed the war as a crusade for democracy. As I've already said, he said, we have to make the world safe for democracy. So it's basically, he portrayed it as dark against light, good against evil, which fit very nicely with his Christian beliefs. Another thing that Wilson did is he had a government agency established, and it was called the Committee on Public Information, or the CPI. This agency grew rapidly with 150,000 employees, and that is huge for back then. Back now, you think, well, a government agency with 150,000 employees, that's small. But that was unprecedented at the time. The job of the CPI was to promote enthusiasm for the war. They had thousands of employees called four-minute men. And this is fascinating. They traveled the country giving four-minute patriotic speeches. In 18 months, almost 400 million spectators heard about 1 million four-minute speeches. So that's really, actually, you got to hand it to them. That's pretty efficient and pretty effective way. They didn't bore people with hour-long speeches. Sometimes these speeches were given in between movies, like 4 minutes, I think, was the time it took to take off one reel and put on the reel for the next movie. So very interesting. The CPI also commissioned their own movies, patriotic movies. And then we have to talk about the German language. We saw how the government demonized Germany. The German language and culture were discouraged in the U.S. German works of music were shunned by American orchestras. German language newspapers were shut down. German language church services were stopped. And they started changing the names of foods. For example, sauerkraut became known as Liberty Cabbage. Hamburgers were renamed Liberty Sandwiches. And even the German measles were now called Liberty Measles. Think about that for a second.
Be liberated from your health. For listeners who are young, if you don't remember the run-up to the Iraq War, when France didn't join the coalition, some people wanted to call French fries freedom fries instead. And we laughed at that because of how hokey and goofy it was. And I'm not completely sure, but I believe that French toast used to be German toast. I don't know if that's true or apocryphal, but... yeah, whip people into a frenzy with the changing of food names, and that's how you do it.
Yeah, it was just really, it was a frenzy, like you said. It was out of control. People with German surnames anglicized them. They didn't want to be seen as some kind of fifth column. They didn't want to be seen as possible enemy spies. So, for example, if your name was Schmidt, you might change it to Smith. If your name was Schumacher, you might change it to Shoemaker or something like that. Others of non-English descent were encouraged to fully Americanize. Germans in the U.S. were required to register as enemy aliens. And sadly, some German Americans were beaten, tarred, and feathered, and even killed. So just loyal Germans or German Americans were often suffered greatly just because of their ancestry. Now, talking about food, there was no food rationing, but limiting the consumption of certain foods was strongly encouraged and enforced through peer pressure. Moving ahead to 1918, we're getting a little bit ahead of our narrative, but we're just looking thematically here at the U.S. involvement. On January 8, 1918, Wilson laid out American war aims very clearly in a set of principles famously known as the 14 points. And I won't list all 14 of them. But among the most significant were national self-determination, open covenants or treaties, disarmament, freedom of the seas, free trade, a free Poland, and most importantly, a League of Nations, which would provide selective security. As we will see, most of these are going to be completely ignored, and almost none of them are going to go into practice. The League of Nations will, but without the U.S. involved, which is kind of ironic since the U.S. president thought of it. 14 points were intended partly to counter Bolshevik propaganda, and they were received enthusiastically by many people around the world. Wilson became a hero. But on the other hand, some European leaders saw Wilson as naive, moralistic, and presumptuous. We already touched on that. Georges Clemenceau, the tiger, the prime minister of France from late 1916. He said famously, God gave us the 10 commandments and we broke them. Wilson gives us the 14 points. We will see. I think there's another quote. I couldn't nail this one down, but I remember hearing somebody else saying, well, God only needed 10 commandments, but Wilson's got to have 14. I was like, Wilson's even making himself out to be bigger than God. Of course, Wilson didn't mean it that way, but Wilson was just very idealistic and I think quite a bit naive about the European situation. Some of the points were in conflict with the Allies' war aims and actions. So we'll see. They're going to try. It's a good try, Wilson, but the Europeans are basically not going to play ball with the 14 points. More on that later.
He has good aims, like you said, but for him as a product of academia, it does sound like a university statement. Our 14 beliefs at Princeton are number one, a sustainable campus. Number two, a place of diversity and inclusion. And that kind of idealism sounds right. Like that is points.
Right.
So looking just kind of moving the name thing for industrialization and mobilization, just before James paints a picture more clearly. Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. I want to first note, the American military is in a very sorry state, or maybe not a sorry state, but it is not a nation that's equipped to fight a total war on an intercontinental scale. Our military was much more modest, and it was designed to meet the challenges of the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, which is basically internal security and to manage affairs very close to its borders. The Army numbers before World War I was 127,000 strong, 67,000 National Guard and Federal Service, and another 100,000 National Guard troops controlled by state governors. The military strength of the United States is on par with Portugal at this time. And it wasn't prepared for anything like trench warfare or modern warfare. It was an army suited to fight Apaches or Filipino insurgents, but nothing to face down enemy armies with artillery and machine guns and airplanes. What France and Britain, they didn't want 100,000 troops to help them. They wanted 1 million men. So America needed to massively, massively expand what it was at the time. So how does that go?
Well, let me first give a little background about industry and politics before we get into the military situation. The federal government became actively involved in the economy. They founded the War Industries Board to manage the mobilization and just the gearing up the economy for war. They set standard prices and profits and tried to prepare the U.S. economy for full mobilization. And they used the threat of nationalization to get U.S. corporations to cooperate. In fact, Wilson did nationalize the railroad network during the war. The government sold Liberty Bonds to help pay for the war. And they had movie stars and other celebrities go out and give speeches promoting them. This of course, is going to be done in World War II as well. That's more famous, but Liberty Bonds are just basically people contributing and on the promise of being paid back with interest after the war. All right, the income tax, which had been passed in 1917, was expanded. Yay, income tax. And the Food and Fuel Act, which was also passed in 1917 in August, it used price controls to spur production and decrease consumption. Under this law, a young, very successful and wealthy engineer named Herbert Hoover was made food administrator.
I trust him to handle something with an economy. I think he's got a good head on his shoulders.
Well, he does at this point. I think, as our listeners all know, he's going to have a big future as president, but it's not going to go well. I think at this point, he's definitely in his personal zone and at his skill level. I think the presidency is a little bit above his pay grade and his talent level, but that's another story. That's after World War I, so we're going to stick to World War I. During the war, industrial production boomed, as I mentioned earlier, but this led to a shortage of workers. The power of labor unions increased, and 1 million women entered the workforce. And everybody knows about World War II and Rosie the Riveter and how millions of American women entered the workforce, but it also happened in World War I, not on as large of a scale, but nevertheless, it is significant. And here's kind of one of the dark sides of Wilson's presidency. During the war, the U.S. government really cracked down on free speech. They just kind of took the First Amendment and set it aside. The press was censored, and Congress passed two notorious laws, which really not that many Americans today know about. But the first of these laws was called the Espionage Act of June 1917, and then the Sedition Act of May 1918. These cracked down on speech viewed as hostile to the war effort. And a lot of people were thrown in jail. A lot of newspapers were shut down for criticizing Wilson or the government. These, I should say, are much more repressive and much more harsh than the ones that John Adams always gets pilloried for. John Adams signed the Alien and Sedition Act back in the late 1700s. These are much more repressive. A lot of people were ruined by these laws. The American Socialist, the most famous example is the American Socialist leader Eugene Debs. He was jailed for a speech in which he defended opposition to the war, and he stayed in jail until after Wilson left the presidency. He was eventually pardoned by President Harding in, I think it was 1921. But Debs and many other anti-war people, they were just locked up. Many people were fined, and as I mentioned before, a lot of careers were ruined by these laws. This is one reason Wilson is not seen as a great president today, at least by most people. I think some people still do, but this is one of many dark sides of Wilson's presidency. Some of them we won't go into, but you can do your own research, folks, and do a little research on Wilson and make your own judgment. All right, so now let's go into the military situation. Scott mentioned how the U.S. Army was really, really small, 127,000 people. The National Guard, I came up with the number of 120,000, but I know National Guard numbers are not all that reliable back at this time. So very, very, very small army. But the U.S. built up the military with great speed. In May 1917, Congress passed the Selective Service Act. In other words, the draft. By the end of the war, 3 million men would be drafted, and the total number of American servicemen was 5 million. About a fifth of these were foreign-born. Some of them were from an Irish background. Some of them were from a German background. So it's an interesting situation.
We have very, very faint shades of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Not nearly as bad, but you know, just a tiny bit.
Yeah, and probably two or three Turkish Americans as well.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah. All right, so to command this new massive army that the U.S. is drafting and bringing into existence, the president selected General John J. Blackjack Pershing to command the American Expeditionary Force. Pershing had a long military career. He had served in the American West, fighting against the Indians in the late 1800s. He had fought in the Philippines, he'd fought in the Spanish-American War, and he most recently had led the so-called punitive expedition against Pancho Villa, the famous Mexican political revolutionary and bandit. They never caught Villa, but nevertheless, Pershing was seen as a very gifted and talented commander, and so he was made the overall commander of the AEF, American Expeditionary Force. The Army quickly built sixteen large compounds where the new recruits would be prepared for going overseas. And American soldiers gained the nickname of Doughboys. No one knows for sure where this came from. I've heard different theories. It may have come from the shape of their buttons. Scott, you had another theory.
Yeah, one is that they looked healthier than European soldiers, doughy. Nowadays, we mean someone is obese, but back then, not being real thin was a sign of health. I found a quote from Vera Brittain. She was an English nurse. And when she first saw the American soldiers arriving, she said that they looked larger than ordinary men. Their tall, straight figures were in vivid contrast to the undersized armies of pale recruits to which we had grown accustomed. So if you're a European and used to seeing someone who's been on the front for years and is rail thin, shell-shocked, has probably suffered many illnesses, then you see someone newly arrived who's off the farm, corn-fed, healthy, optimistic. It really stands out in contrast. That's one theory, but we don't know, listeners, so, well, that's the best we can do.
Yeah, maybe tell us what your theory is in the comments or somewhere, wherever you can, or send us an email or something. But yeah, it was a real shock to the Europeans to see all these big strapping guys coming over with total confidence and the typical American swagger, which is present in every war pretty much. It took a long time to get this army up and running. You know, you can't just snap your fingers and all of a sudden you have a professional army. These guys are, as Scott mentioned, they're farm boys. Some of them are store clerks, you know, they're teachers and they're all different professions and they're not professional soldiers. Only a handful of them are. So they're trained as much as is possible. And then they start trickling over to Europe. The first American soldiers landed in France on May 16th, 1917. But again, this is just a very small initial token force. The arrival of the American Expeditionary Force, AEF, was very gradual, as I said. But by the end of the war, 2 million more would arrive. And they were hailed as heroes by the French. They arrived in France and marched through France toward the front. They didn't have a lot of gear, though. American soldiers tended to have to use French or British weapons and gear. And for many of the American soldiers, coming to Europe was a great adventure. The U.S. wasn't overwhelmingly rural. I don't know what the percent is. I think more people by this point lived in cities than on farms, but not a ton. It might have been somewhere around 50-50. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that.
I think you're absolutely right. I talked to a book author who said that inflection point of population from rural to city hit almost exactly in 1918. So
yeah,
it's a tipping point for America in a lot of ways. It goes from more rural to more industrial city-based, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and my point is behind that is that a lot of these guys had never been more than 10, 20 miles from their homes, their farms, or their towns. And so here they are marching through Paris, this ancient and cosmopolitan and great big city where the people are very different, the culture is very different. It was really something new for a lot of these guys. The American leaders, and especially General Pershing, wanted to keep American forces together as an integrated unit. And they fought again and again and again. The French and British just were dying to break up the Americans. You know, give us 500 here, give us 1,000 here. They wanted to fill in the gaps and fill in all the places where they'd lost a lot of their own soldiers. The French and British did. They wanted to. Some of them didn't even want the Americans to have officers higher than captain. They wanted just the Americans to just basically be temporary British soldiers or temporary French soldiers, and Pershing and his bosses, the Secretary of War, Newton Baker, and Wilson. Even Wilson wasn't all that interested in the X's and O's, but Pershing in particular said, no, I want to have an integrated American unit, a separate American army we'll fight wherever you want us to, but don't break us up. In the end, he did allow occasionally some small American units to plug in to French and British lines. But for the most part, he was successful in gaining the Americans' right to be a separate army. All right. You had quite a few African-American soldiers served, about 400,000 in all. That's about twice the number that fought in the Civil War. They all served in segregated units. But they did, and the African-Americans tended to serve under French command, the exception to the rule I stated earlier. There was one particular unit called the Harlem Hellfighters that fought incredibly bravely, and they were really tough, really great fighters. And they received the Croix de Guerre, which is the war cross, the highest French award from the French government. So the French really appreciated them. They felt very more appreciated by the French than they did by their own government. The first American attack occurred on May 28, 1918 at the village of Cantigny. And then in June of 1918 at Belleau Wood, American forces stopped a German advance. By the way, the U.S. Marines were heavily involved in this too. It wasn't just the Army. This is one instance where the Marines were not fulfilling their traditional role of being amphibious troops. After this, the AEF went on the attack. We'll talk more about this later when we go into the battles in more detail, but just suffice it to say that in September of 1918 at Saint-Mihiel and then in the Meuse-Argonne offensive, the American forces, both Army and Marines, were very active. And then, of course, spoiler alert, the war ends in November 11th, 1918. All told, in World War I, 116,000 American soldiers died. 53,000 of those were in combat, and 63,000 died of disease and other causes. The most significant disease was the Spanish flu, which we will again talk about in a future episode. But yeah, so the Americans played a significant role. Their casualties were nowhere near what the other nations suffered, but some say that the Americans tipped the balance and really were the final blow to the Germans. They provided fresh bodies, fresh enthusiasm, a lot of energy, and fierce fighting power. I've also heard people say that the Americans, it was mainly, they gave them moral support. It was kind of more like building the spirits of the Allies. So I don't know. I tend to go with the fact that they did actually help significantly militarily, but you know, there's people have argued this for a long time. One other thing I want to mention is that many future American political and military leaders served in World War I. And just a few of the names I'll mention were Harry Truman. Harry Truman was a captain of artillery in World War I. George Marshall. George Marshall was a master of logistics, even as a young man. And that's going to obviously come out even more so in World War II. Douglas MacArthur. William Donovan, who later becomes known as Wild Bill and becomes the head of the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA. And of course, George Patton. George Patton kind of cut his teeth on tanks in World War I and then becomes a major army commander in World War II. Our listeners may be wondering, what about Eisenhower? Well, Eisenhower actually did not serve in World War I. I mean, he was in the army, but he had administrative and staff positions back in the United States. Much to his chagrin, he wanted to go fight in the battle, but they just said, we need you here in your current job. So Eisenhower did not set foot in Europe all during World War I. That's all I got, Scott. What do you think?
Yeah, that's really good. And some other resources listeners will mention, a book that I've looked at a lot for the American experience in World War I is by H.W. Crocker called The Yanks Are Coming. All of these battles get into much more detail, Mouzargon, Saint-Mihiel. And the book takes a stance. It argues against the idea that America should not have been involved in World War I. Some of the arguments state that had America not got involved, it could have led to a victory of the Central Powers. And that would have been a bad thing because Germany at the time of the Second Reich had was a militaristic, moving toward a dictatorship. And it's not as if World War II would have been avoided. It would have been a much stronger Germany, and it could have projected this all over Europe. Another point he makes is that America was prepared for World War II in a way it would not have been if not for its experiences in World War I. In addition to Marshall, MacArthur, Patton, and others who gained battle experience here, America builds up its military infrastructure, and it does graduate from being a nation that protects against Indian raids and maybe goes into forays in the Pacific and the Philippines into a nation that can fight international war. Was America underprepared in the 1930s? Did it have to massively build up its base in the 1940s? Of course. World War II, that's very well known that America had to flip the switch back to a wartime economy and build up its resources, much like it did in World War I, but it wasn't building from nothing in the same way, to a sense, in World War I. It was more reactivating what it had had before and rebuilding its industrial machine. That's one take, and a book I've gone into in depth in our membership program is called Rendezvous with Death, about the experiences of Americans who fight with the French Foreign Legion before America is involved, and you can read more about the exploits of the Escadrille Americaine, or Escadrille Lafayette, sorry, everyone. And we had talked about other Americans like Eugene Boulard, the first African-American fighter pilot. He has an incredible story in his involvement in World War I and World War II. A great book about him is called The Black Swallow of Death, and I think it shows, like James mentioned, many African-Americans really appreciated what France was doing to acknowledge their support in a way that America didn't. And Eugene Boulard spends much of the early 20th century in France thinking, well, I'm going to have a better time there than I in America, so I'm going to experience it there, and you can see what that's like. So that's what I'll add here. And we'll come back to a lot of these themes in future episodes. But what do you think, James, the next episode? Should we look a little more at tanks?
Yes. I love tanks. Tanks are finally going to get their day in the sun in our next key battle.
Yeah, we're going to look at the Battle of Cambrai in the next episode. See you there. All right, well, that is all I have to say for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chrissy, David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my Spy Masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Dalton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Dalton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spy Master level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.